KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of What the Festival, a music and arts festival June 19th through the 22nd at the Wolf Run Ranch in Dufour, Oregon. What the Festival features over 80 electronic and dance artists on four large stages, including artists such as Big Gigantic, Odessa, Rob Garza of Thievery Corporation, Toki Monsta, Thomas Jacks, Tropical Pool Party, Keys and Crates, and the Funk Hunters with Charlie Tuna of Jurassic 5. Again, that's the What the Festival, June 19th through the 22nd at the Wolf Run Ranch in Dufour, Oregon, just 90 miles east of Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. Welcome to Between the Covers. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and my guest is Marian Palaya. Her new novel, The Given World, has received rave reviews from writers Lori Moore, Karen Joy Fowler, and Robert Olin Butler, among many. Spanning 25 years, The Given World moves from Montana to Saigon as it tells the story of a young woman whose life is haunted by her brother's disappearance in Vietnam. Marian Palaya will be reading from The Given World tonight at 7:30 at Powell's on Hawthorne. Marian Palaya, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you so much for coming in. In The Given World, you create a portrait of post-Vietnam America. Why did you choose to write about this particular period of time?
Well, because it's my life. Just totally my life. I mean, all our lives from the 70s were pretty infused by that war and what came after it. So it was somewhat autobiographical, but not totally.
And would you say that you fell into the same age range as the main character?
Almost exactly, yes.
We see things from her point of view. Riley, she is the woman at the center of this novel, and the story takes her from about the age of 13.
Actually 9 in the first chapter when her brother's still at home, and then she's 13 when he goes missing.
And takes her to when?
About 40, I guess.
That's what I was thinking. It's
a little bit finessed in there. I don't know why, but it seemed like an awful broad span, so I kind of smudged it a little bit.
And it takes her, as we mentioned, from Montana and then to San Francisco, to Vietnam, and back to the States. Can you talk about Riley and how you conceived of her as a character?
She actually began as a character in just a standalone short story about 15 years ago. And it was the chapter that's now called Girl Three Speeds, Pretty Good Breaks. And that was the title of the story. And it was just supposed to be a story about a kind of a lost girl working in a gas station. And she had that that beat up old Mustang, which was actually my car. And so that's all it was for about 10 years, was just a short story. And then I went to Madison to do my MFA. And when I began writing stories for my workshops there, she just sort of reappeared and in that bar in Saigon, and then she reappeared again. So Lori Moore and I sat down and decided that it was a novel, and it scared me to death, but I just kept going. So
that must have been a great experience to have Lori Moore guiding you on that.
Absolutely. Everybody at Madison was great, but Lori was our first workshop professor when we all first got there in 2010, and she's always been one of my favorite writers, so working with her was really a gift. And she's the one, when she read the Vietnam piece, I had kind of given it a soft landing, and she said, you put the stake in, but then you took it back out. And she said, what would happen if you left it in? And I was, that really changed everything for me. I thought, okay, she's saying I have to write things that are hurt, things that are hard. And so that was the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And yet I read that something that you said about tragic heroes.
Not being tragic.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that was, I got that from Ricky Lee Jones way back when I was actually sort of a tragic character. I had sort of a messy life for a few years, longer than a few years. And, you know, and Ricky Lee Jones did too. She's kind of a touchstone for me. But she was talking about, it was an interview in Rolling Stone in probably about 80, 81, 82. And she said Tom Waits always wanted for us to be poor Mexicans with the kids in the back of the station wagon at the drive-in. And she said, you know, for a while that was good and it was material. And she said, but something along the lines of, you know, if that's where your work, where your creativity comes from, is from being sad and miserable and tragic, what happens if you wake up one day and you're okay and you're happy? Then what do you do? So I guess what she was saying is that it has to come from a deeper place than that. Mm-hmm. And I wrote those stories for years, and it was sort of my apprenticeship, but I don't want to be that tragic cowgirl anymore.
And let's talk a little bit about your writing background, how you sort of progressed. It's a little different than what's seen right now as a traditional kind of work.
Nothing traditional about it. I didn't even know that creative writing was a discipline in 1982, I think, is when I started my undergrad. I was living in Montana at the time. I'd sort of run away from home from college and gotten married. And I went to the University of Montana in Missoula, and I was studying journalism because I thought that that's what writers did, was they took journalism classes. And my journalism professor was very sweet, but he knew that I made up all my stories, basically. I didn't live in Missoula. I lived 50 miles outside of town, so I was supposed to cover city council meetings and things like that, and I couldn't because it was just too far. So I just made up stories, like the Drummond Loggers Wives Association meeting, and, you know, which devolved into a brawl and stuff like this. And Bob would always say, this is great, but you made this up, right? And I always say, no, I didn't make this up. This is really true. So anyway, at the end of the semester, I confessed, and he said, you know, you can write. He said, but you're in the wrong department. So he actually, I mean, this is the way I remember it. Of course, this is more than 30 years ago, but, you know, that he actually took me by the hand and walked me over to the liberal arts building and introduced me to Richard Hugo, who was the head of the creative writing program then, and said, I've got a live one for you, Dick. And I was just amazed. I just had no idea that you could study creative writing, that it was something, that it was a discipline at all. And it was... Yeah, it was a life-changing moment. And I had great teachers there, and really the students in that program, they weren't even in the program. We were all undergrads, and we were really amazing. So, and that was, you know, like I said, 82, 83. And then I got my first master's at San Francisco State in 1990, and that was in creative writing before they had an MFA. And then took 20 years off. I didn't take it off. I kept writing. But I think I look at that as my apprenticeship years. I really do. I just kept reworking the same material over and over and over again. So.
And what were you doing for a living at that time?
Oh, you name it. Mostly bartending at a little neighborhood/lesbian bar in San Francisco. And I also drove a newspaper truck for 6 years. And so that's where that material comes from. And that was a great job. It was really fun.
That was the middle of the night work?
Yeah. I say now it was really fun. It wasn't always really fun, but it had its moments. And they paid us enough money. That was how I afforded to go live for a year in Vietnam, is because we were Teamsters and they paid us pretty well. And I didn't have any dependents or any obligations. So I was able to just save $10,000 and move to Vietnam for a year. So, and then after that, I went back to Montana and I was working at the university and I had a very secure, stable, bureaucratic job and I hated my life. So I loved the people I worked with, but I'm not a good bureaucrat. So that's why I went back to school. And there it was.
Well, you have said some things about having, I guess what I'm reading between the lines or whatever, but that having had the experiences that you have had in your life, informing your work is something that you feel is very valuable compared to people who go through a more traditional now system and come out of a writing program without much real world experience.
Yeah, I think I'm probably walking on thin ice a little bit when I get into this, but because I know that there are people, young people, who have already had incredible life experiences by the time they get into an MFA or whatever, but there are also there's this trajectory that some people follow, and there's nothing wrong with it, but I don't really know how to put this in a politically correct way, maybe. I don't know. I just feel that there's a lack sometimes of an awareness of the broader world and what's going on out in the world that doesn't apparently affect all of us directly. And as a teacher, I sometimes feel like part of my job should be current events. You know, like come to class and say, okay, what happened in Syria last week? Or, you know, what's going on with the Palestinians? Or, you know, what's Russia up to? But I don't do that. But for my writing anyway, it was actually very, very important for me to have been out in the world and learned what I did about what's going on.
I'm speaking with Marian Palaya. We're on Between the Covers on KBOO Portland. I'm Kathleen Stevenson. Marian Palaya's new novel is The Given World, and she will be reading from it and talking about it tonight at Powell's on Hawthorne. And we mentioned the connection to Vietnam, and part of the book does take place in Vietnam. And Marian is going to read from the very beginning of the book that's set there.
Okay. This is the prologue. Jasper says this is the kind of heat that makes people in Australia shoot each other, or stab, strangle, run over, whatever. But we are not in Australia. We are in a once infamous city whose inhabitants still call it Saigon. It has not rained in months, but tonight it will, and the rain will go more or less unmentioned, but not unnoticed. It will still be hot, but the relief will be palpable. In Australia, they will stop killing each other, but only if they get some rain there, too. We have been waiting, playing pool and drinking beer, and sometimes when we can't take it anymore, finding air-conditioned places that will let us in. In those places, you pay the usual dollar for a 333 beer, two more dollars for the air. The Caravelle is one of those places, and the Rex, and now these fancy new restaurants appearing block by block, almost overnight. There is a swimming pool on the roof of the Rex, and it is often full of corpulent Russian tourists, suntanned like scraped cowhide. They are loud, and they never come to the Lotus. This is our bar, no aircon, rats the size of puppies, but they stay in the corners, usually, until closing time. The government here is renting Jasper from Australia so he can teach young Vietnamese pilots how to fly passenger planes. He is part of a contingent of Qantas boys, another of whom has managed to woo me into bed, which really didn't require all that much effort. This other one looks vaguely like Jim Morrison and has a room at the Rex with aircon and a bathtub. We are not in love, not by a long shot. If he were one of the French boys, maybe I would be in love. The Aussie is mainly in love with himself, but the bathtub is nice. It slows down the process of going crazy.
And you spent time in Vietnam.
I was there for a year, in 94.
How did you happen to go there?
I had always been fascinated just by the idea of Vietnam, which, of course, when I got there, I realized I knew nothing about. But when I worked at the newspaper, the paper boys that who I hired and who worked for me were Vietnamese, for the most part. And by the time I'd run my own district for more than about 3 weeks, they were all Vietnamese because they were amazing kids. And some of the adult newspaper carriers too, and some of them had been in refugee camps or had family in refugee camps, and I just got to know them and their families, and I was just very fascinated by the culture and how resilient they were. And a friend of mine got me a job teaching English in Hong Kong the summer of 92. And I went just for a few months, and I fell in love with Asia. I didn't know what to expect, and it just kind of blew me away. It was just so different, and I realized since that I love that feeling of disassociation, of just not knowing where I am or what's going on. I decided after that summer that I was going to move to Saigon, and all my friends were like, either you are so crazy, or of course you are. So I saved $10,000 in about a year, and then I just packed up and moved to Saigon. And I remember the morning I left Hong Kong to fly to Saigon, and I was just a wreck. I had no idea. I didn't know anybody. I didn't know the language. I just went, but it was, I mean, obviously a totally life-changing experience, and I loved it. I loved it. Mm-hmm. Saigon is an amazing city. It's crazy. It is completely nuts, but it was great.
So you are a wanderer. Do you consider yourself a wanderer? There's
absolutely.
Yeah. And in the book, in The Given World, Riley is a wanderer. Mm-hmm. How did you go about conveying that quality to her, or that, how did you deal
in
with
the writing?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. That's just one of those things, just the one word in front of another. Mm. I mean, Riley is very much like me. I think that's probably obvious to anybody who knows me. She isn't me. And, you know, part of our stories overlap and much of it doesn't, but I don't know. I mean, a lot of what draws her to places, I think, is the same thing, or the same things that have drawn me to places, and the ocean being one of them. I mean, that's really a critically important thing in my life. And I think once I started just trying to figure out how to get that sensibility into her, you know, that longing for some place that she'd never seen. I don't know, maybe it just got easier over time. I have no idea. Traveling, I'm not allowed to carry my passport with me if I go to the airport, because I'm liable to just get on a plane to who knows where. If it weren't for my dog, I would not. He has grounded me. I've had him for 9 years, and I've been places, but not like I used to be. Mm. But seriously, I don't get to carry my passport.
And Riley's world is pretty gritty.
Yeah.
And I assume you drew on your experiences as a bartender to depict her life and your experiences in the newspaper delivery world, mm-hmm. also. Talk a little bit about that, about writing about that.
That was, you know, back to the conversations with Lori Moore. Those were hard things to write, and a couple of the people in the book, specifically Lou and Cole, are based on very closely on people that I knew and loved very much, who were, they were pretty messy, and they're both dead now from bad living. And
they were both in San Francisco.
They both were denizens of the bar where I worked, the Wild Side West. And I don't know why I'm so drawn to wounded people, but I seem to be. And like Lou in particular, that wasn't her real name, but people just steered clear of her because people were afraid of her. But for some reason, as soon as I met her, I mean, the description of meeting her in the book is very close to what happened. She was just berating this blind woman in the bar, but and everybody was like, whoa, you know, stay away from her, she's mean. But there, I just saw something in her. And Cole was the same. He was just he was a kid, and he was a wounded kid. But I don't know. I loved writing. I mean, in the actual physical process of writing about these guys, it was almost like they were in the room with me. And that was so, I mean, it was just really special, and I loved doing that. But it was also very, very, very hard. And reading those words, and just like, God, where are these guys? I want them to come back, but mm-hmm. they don't get to.
And there is almost a theme in the book of ghosts. I mean, the main mm-hmm. Riley's predicament of having loved her brother so much, and her brother going missing in Vietnam, that dominates things. So there is that feeling of loss.
Yeah, I just did a soundtrack for the Large Hearted Boy blog. And he just put it up today, and it's there's a Spotify playlist, and one of the songs I put on it was a Little Feat song called "It's So Easy to Slip," and the line, "It's so to let your memory drift and do nothing at all." There's something about the people that we can't recall. Do they really exist at all? And that song just really hits me, is because we really are, I think, made of the people that we've known, you know, and not just the experiences that we've had, but everybody that we spend any time with sort of adds to that whatever puzzle of who we are. And there were some very wild times in my life, not just the people I wrote about, but my life too. But I look back and there are things I regret, but I don't regret any of those people, and I don't regret any of those adventures, really. I certainly don't regret knowing those people, because as hurtful as it was to watch them do what they did to themselves, I just feel like I wouldn't be the person that I am mm-hmm. if it weren't for all those people. Like, so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Marion Palaya. Again, she will be speaking tonight at Powell's on Hawthorne. She'll be talking about her new book, The Given World. This is KBOO Portland. Your writing process includes a lot of revising?
A lot.
Can you talk a little bit about how that works for you?
How it works for me is that I'm an incredibly slow writer. I miss the days when I could just sit down in a bar with a hangover and knock out a short story, and those days are long over. But that's when I thought that, you know, I could just toss it out there and it would be good. by the time I have written 10 pages, the first 9 pages have been rewritten 90 times. I mean, it's really that. I think it, in a way, it's avoiding writing new material because it's hard for me. I know that for a lot of writers that's the easy part, or not. It's none of it's easy, but writing the first draft and just getting the first draft out of the way. But I just edit constantly, and I know it is part of it is just avoiding writing what's new. I'm working on a new novel, and I've been working on it for 2.5 years now. And I've got 165 pages, which isn't, for me, that's a lot. And I've been doing other things too. There's a lot I'm finding involved with publishing a book because my editor gives me assignments all the time, you know, write a modern love column or write, you know, a blog post or whatever. So I've been busy, but I haven't been that busy. But the thing is, by the time I'm done with this second book, if it's the book I want it to be, I mean, if the plot structure works for my editor and if it works as a novel at all, it will be pretty close to done because at the sentence level it's definitely done. But I don't know, the macro issues, that's up to Trish, that's up to my editor, so we'll see.
Yeah. And did the new novel come out of the same kind of world that the given world?
It has definitely similarities. It also takes place in San Francisco and Montana. This one, the main character, her name is Lucky. She starts out in San Francisco and ends up in Montana and then goes back. So she's sort of on the opposite track of Riley. But it's a little bit, things blow up in this novel. And nothing blew up in The Given World. But one of the early editorial comments we got when my agent first started sending The Given World out was that it was too quiet. And I revised it after that and I guess loudened it up a little bit. But as that was happening, you know, when I was hearing that, I started the second novel and I thought, okay, I can do loud. So we'll blow some things up. So it's sort of Thelma and Louise meets Breaking Bad, kind of, but not really. Yeah.
And are you able to work on writing full time now?
Oh yeah, it is such a gift. I pinch myself every day, because as 99% of the writers out there know, writing and working it's really hard. You have to be incredibly disciplined, and I am not that disciplined. So I have enormous respect for anybody. I have a stepsister-in-law who's also a novelist, and she works full-time and has a teenage daughter and a husband and cats and a household to keep together, and she's writing her second novel, and I just have enormous respect for her and anybody like her that is able to do that. I get to get up in the morning and write and have coffee and walk my dog and then come back and edit, and it's a gift, and I appreciate every second of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a pleasure to read the book and a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for coming into KBOO. And I want to let people know again that Marian Palaya has been my guest on Between the Covers, and she will be reading from The Given World tonight at 7:30 at Powell's on Hawthorne. This has been Between the Covers. I'm Kathleen Stevenson. If you missed any of this interview or want to hear it again, you can go to kboo.fm, and it will be available in a little while today. And we're going out with some more music that was referenced in The Given World. It's a little Van Morrison and Jackie Wilson said.
Yeah. Thank you.
Portland school board elections are May 19th. What's your question?
My name is Michael Mayo. I serve as the elected secretary of the Eastside Democratic Club. Have you thought through the policy of whittling away the autonomy and the initiative of the teacher of your children?
Tune in to KBOO April 27th through 30th at 5:45 for special school board election coverage.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move you.